Good evening. Thank you so much for coming, everybody. I'm Ann Temkin, curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture and organizer of the exhibition Against the Grain. The routine here at the museum over the last, year and a half since we've been open has been trying to put together our audience with the makers of the work on view much more often than perhaps was done in the past. And for that, of course, we rely on the generosity of time and thought on the part of the artists themselves. And tonight we have two fantastic sculptors here, Judith Shea and Joel Shapiro, and both of them have kindly agreed to talk about sculpture. And as you know, if you've seen the installation of the gifts from Edward Broida down on the second floor, there is an unusual amount of sculpture in Mr. Broida's collection. In general, and those of you who are also artists probably know, sculpture is a harder thing to set oneself to than painting if one is thinking in terms of being collected and being displayed. Now, fortunately, this isn't the kind of thing maybe that artists in art school are thinking about when they're 20 years old. But there's no question that it's a bigger challenge because everybody needs a painting for their wall and not everybody needs a perhaps 20-foot object for their living room floor. And one of the really refreshing things about Broida's collecting, as you may well know, is he was not collecting for his house or, in fact, even for some attached gallery or anything like that. He was collecting at first for what he had hoped would be a museum in Soho, which he had plans to build in the 1980s, in the mid-80s. But then having abandoned that ambition by the end of the 80s, he still went on collecting as if he were collecting for an institution, not as a private individual, and went on buying sculpture and paintings and works on paper with absolutely no intent to show them. He just amassed them in warehouses throughout the country and really supported in a very, very serious way artists of all sorts by buying their work constantly and consistently and in great quantity with no thought as to logistics or convenience. So we were very happy when we were invited to select the gifts from Broida's collection that we would like to receive, that we had the opportunity to dig into the work of several sculptors, which MoMA itself had been slow to pick up on, perhaps, or had not bought of the same body of work that was existing in Broida's collection. And we're, taking advantage of this opportunity with the exhibition to display it with the kind of space and with the kind of dialogue between objects that the depth of that collection afforded. Judith Shea and Joel Shapiro are both artists working in New York, and they have certain commonalities, certain differences. Both came of age in the generation after minimalism. Both have worked in a pretty consistent way, I would say, over the last 25 years, even though there's been fantastic evolution within each's vocabulary. And how I want to structure tonight is have each of them give us some remarks of their own for about 10 or 15 minutes, 10 or 15 minutes of me asking them things that I've been wondering about, and then open it up to a half hour or so of questions from you. Because really the luxury of having these discussions in the founder's room, as we call it here, as opposed to the theaters downstairs, is that we really want everybody in the audience to feel like they're a participant as much as the people up here. So with that, I'll ask Joel and Judith to join me in front.
Hello, everyone, including some wonderful friends. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, you can if you
say. And can... Am I audible? Oh, okay. I don't know if I'm on this one or this one. I decided, given the... Oops, it started already, but that's okay. given the timing and that my first exhibition was April 1976, to just show you a selection of slides without annotating, without even giving them titles and so on, for you to look at, and then I'll make a few remarks about what you just saw. Basically, in looking back at my work for this evening, and also just in the wonderful opportunity of having the piece crawl in the exhibition, I realized that looking back at images, and you'll probably see it as you see them, my work really falls into almost three precise phases with a lot of variety within the phases, which you can, I think, will be obvious to you. And then I'll talk just briefly about what those phases were about after you've seen the images. But essentially, it breaks down to the first phase I would just call clothes. The second phase I would call three-dimensional figures. And the third phase is people. Okay. These are part of one project, Silk Project, which was April 1976 at the Clock Tower, which was an alternative space in Lower Manhattan, which is also the mother of PS1. And it was given as a performance, and essentially it was about, I would call it living color. So it was a spectrum of colored silk clothing, and then the performance was essentially a dancer putting on and changing clothes, making colors. In 1977, I was the first artist at the Fabric Workshop, and this was a piece called Four Continents. I guess there is enough time to give titles. That's called Katharine Hepburn, Silk Organza. Everything is life scale, but not necessarily anatomically correct. It's made for how it looks as an art object. Nylons, 1976. That's a studio view from the late 70s. Executive secretary. Burlap. I Like Ike. Inaugural ball. These were all 1980.
And what's this made of?
That's organza, also silk organza. Bop, silk taffeta. Also, these cloth pieces were hung on the wall at the level that corresponded to the part of the body that they covered. So it was a very direct sort of mirror relationship for the viewer. Tank, which is the sort of prelude to crawl. Then at this point, you see three dimensions. This is proxy. It's actually acrylic paint on canvas, so it looks like leather, but it isn't leather. Black dress, 1982. This is industrial felt soaked with India ink. This is crawl, that's in the exhibition. This was the first bronze casting. Taking shape, bronze. Acting out, bronze and iron. He and she, bronze. Eden, bronze. Shield, bronze, on a stone base. So this is 1990 now, and 88. Endless model. Where is it? It's in Chicago. Post-Balzac, 1990, bronze. object, 1991, wood. No more monument, 1991, wood. Artist, Castile, 1992. Joan Ford Twain, that's as in Mark Twain, that's 99. Nobody's Angel. So now these are in the 2000s. That's face of icon, 2004, wood and bronze. Urban Francis, 2000, for a few years there, 2002, something like that. And that's his face. This is bronze. And Job, 2005. Bronze. That picture's in Indianapolis. So, you with me on that? That's 30 years and 7 minutes. That Silk Project was the first public exhibition of my work or exposure of my work. It was a studio project, and that was the pilot program at the Clock Tower for PS1, which was the idea that you give an artist a studio, which I had for a month, and then the artist opens the studio to the public. But what I was making was those silk pieces, and so I made it the presentation as a kind of performance at the end. From then on, until around 79 or 80, I continued to work in just whole varieties of ways dealing with the packaging, what I would call the packaging around the figure. You can call it clothes. It really wasn't about fashion per se, but it really wasn't even in a way about clothes. It was about, in some way, the interaction. And also, I did study fashion design and then returned to school to get a fine arts degree. So in a certain way, I learned more about making the figure by learning the technology of clothing making, particularly at that time when I was studying in the late 60s. I would probably have been taught the technology for abstract sculpture making had I been in a different program, because figuration was really so not very viable at the time. In fact, I didn't even know the word figuration until I was long after making figurative work. And the second phase kind of happened as a technological accident, really, which was I kept trying to make these cloth elements more three-dimensional. It was just the way my mind was working, the way I was progressing in the work, and it was constantly a frustration because they wouldn't. No amount of saturating them with things would keep them full. So I started fishing around for ideas of how to make pieces that could stand by themselves or be solid, and I was teaching a class at the Met in the Costume Institute called The History of the Structure of Clothing. And one of the lessons was on armor. And I suddenly thought, hey, there's an idea. And I started casting. So that middle period, of which Crawl was the first bronze, I did a few cast iron pieces earlier than that because you could cast directly from cloth, almost as thin as the cloth, in iron, but bronze is not as hot, so you can't. And lo and behold, the thing that struck me after moving to that step was you know, I thought I was building the figure, but what was overwhelming to me was the presence of the hollow, the inner space of these pieces. And that then became the subject of the works. The next phase, the phase I feel I'm still well in, is what I called earlier people, was at some point I felt that I had played out my interest in the hollow, the use of the hollow to represent inner, you know, something of the inner nature of the person or the lack of inner nature, the lack of inner life, whatever, however it was in different pieces. And I moved on to, I felt compelled to move into complete figuration. And having done that again, the big surprise was to me, as soon as I started to build the complete figure, I found that I was drawn to making the works about the inner life. So it's a whole series of what I would call paradoxes, I suppose. But it also has very much to do with my way of being an artist, which is I make everything more or less myself, not the casting. I work with foundries, but all the other materials. I don't like to work with a lot of assistants. I have had some over the years, but because I feel strongly that the work comes out of that working, the materials are constantly opening up things that I wouldn't have thought of if I gave a design plan to somebody to pursue. And I think you can see that in the variety of materials that I've worked with and of forms that I've tried to work with. Then I think also what's obvious looking back on it finally is the fact that people have often said to me, why are they all females? In fact, they're not. I once made a count, and there are equal numbers of male figures that I've made, but it ends up that the females are always the favorite. I probably, to myself, too, because I've shown most females in this slide presentation. But I think it's a question of not so much a political point of view, though. I think my point of view about being a feminist is that, you know, if you're a woman in the world trying to make your way at anything, you're a feminist, whether you call yourself one or not. But I think more particularly as an artist, and the particular way that I work, since it's so very hands-on, I think, and working with the human figure, so much of it comes out of my experience of being in the world. The way it feels to be in certain kinds of clothes really informed the early clothing work. The hollow space, I actually worked from the hollow out, the way, you know, you people carve clay. It's like the opposite of that. I worked with my hands from the inside, pushing out against sort of the way it feels when you're in a piece of clothing. And it's consistent. I think my experience of being in the world, and I'm a female, is what informs that aspect of the work. So, thank you.
Well, I can't say that I feel consistent being a man. I have a bunch of slides of work. This is work from, I should know this, 19, I don't know. You know, middle 70s, let's say. I think there's a slide missing. Is this starting in the beginning? I don't think so. Now, that's the first slide. Okay, that's a little horse on the wall and a small house. And I think when I began to work, I mean, I was trying to somehow find some meaning in the work that had something to do with my own experience, very much like what Judith is saying. And I think, at least I think for myself, that I always try to identify things and then move on in the work. And I'm not sure if I'm interested in consistency in work. I think I'm more interested in, I mean, I'm interested in a consistent point of view and strong work, but I think work really should probe all kinds of tangential thoughts. And I find that that kind of journey is where, I mean, what goes on with my work. This is, both of these pieces are in That's the little bronze in the exhibition. That's a photograph before it was cast. You know, and it was, you know, slapdash together with small pieces of wood. Very small, maybe 4 inches tall. And the image on the right is the first large-scale figure I did. And I think what I was interested in, I mean, I was on the small pieces, I was sort of interested if I could make a piece that would read as a sign or a symbol. And, you know, you'd read its defensiveness or its, in retrospect, I would look and say, oh, I would try and evoke an emotional aspect by the configuration. And then I found as soon as I had some sense of elation, you know, that that didn't work, that I actually had to function in a broader space. So the early work was in a magical space, and I think the more the work after that, to a large extent, tried to function and operate in the actual world we all occupy, or the space we all occupy. This is a painted wood piece. It would have been a full figure that I truncated, chopped up, and then painted to try and evoke more meaning in the work. A lot of people don't know this work. This is a gouache from 1978 and a wall relief, more or less the same period of time. And again, I mean, I think that, you know, the way I would make these drawings, I think there's been one aspect where I'm always trying, that there's some tendency to organize work around the page and around gravity or the tabletop or the floor or the wall. And I think what I've been looking for is, you know, the moment where work departs from that comfort or that sort of where one's some interior moment organizes the form rather than or overwhelms the conditions of gravity that inform the nature of work. And I think in these pieces I was making a drawing, then I would find a color, and I was walking around in the woods at the time actually, and I'd find a color that really engaged me, and I tried to use the color to separate away from the page so you could see the drawing as kind of architecture, or I would say maybe you could see the drawing as culture. No, that doesn't work. But I have this idea of nature, culture, but it doesn't quite cut it. And what I wanted the paint to leap off the page, so the actual color kind of moved, the color and the form moved away from the flatness of the page. And I think I tried to do the same thing in the reliefs, where the color would dislocate the form. They were very small, 7 or 8 inches. The drawings are bigger. I tried to do this in scale. There's a brown drawing where I drew a shape, a little green piece from the same period of time where I would sort of put... And I wanted an immediacy in the work. That's a kind of seductive drawing. I don't think in this drawing what I was sort of trying to... I don't think I was trying to do anything except separate the act of making work from the flatness of the page, from the given situation. And I think that's a particularly successful relief on the right where it really became independent of the wall. The prior ones, and I was very suspicious about aspects of my work that were flat to the wall and built out from the wall, and I was interested in this sort of real conception where you make the piece independent of the support. Needless to say, it has to be supported. And I think that's something that's been consistent in my work. This is a painted wood piece, a house and a figure painted, broken apart, stuck together. This is a piece, we're leaping way forward. This is sort of, late 90s, where I was sort of tossing elements of wood in the air and then screwing them in to establish this matrix so the form was independent of the ground. More recent work, hanging stuff in painted wood. This is sort of 2001. At one point, I found that this work actually, I mean, this was the first piece. You know, you get this little gift of a first piece that's great, then try and recapture that kind of energy that went into it. It's very hard to do. It actually doesn't happen too often. But I found a lot of these pieces where I was suspending shapes and propping them up were kind of somewhat inanimate. I mean, they didn't have enough emotion for me after a certain point. So I began to use malleable wire to suspend elements and parts. These are bigger. Color again. I did a whole series of these sort of ox blood red pieces. I got this great review in San Francisco where the critic was looking at it. He said, yes, this piece was a kind of critique of U.S. brutality so they looked like bleeding, hanging figures, which was not my intent. I mean, I was much more interested in 9/11 and the collapse of form. This is a painted wood piece where I use paint to differentiate from one part. So you kind of have the... Now you have the nature of the wood and the culture of the paint. Paint's just... Color is really this conceptual concept. I mean, you take something that's natural like wood and cover it with paint and it becomes some other... This is a piece that I completed last year and that I exhibited at the Musée Orsay in Paris. I selected this piece in relationship to Carpeaux's dance. It sort of worked, actually. And it was great because the piece was so vibrant and lively, and that ground floor is so dull and oppressive and so loaded with natural material and bronze and stone. And it's so heavy. This piece really kind of popped and flew. Now, it's back in my studio. It went somewhere, but some kid jumped on it. Fatal Attraction, so I'm rebuilding the piece. That's it. It's my 10 minutes. I'm done.
So let's see if our mics work in the seats that we're sitting in. I think you can hear me fine.
Yes.
So I'm going to be the art historian, if you'll pardon me, and rewind in both of your cases like 30 years. And one of the interesting questions for me is how each of you, having had what was most immediately prior be this school of sculpture, thinking minimalism of Donald Judd or Carl Andre or whomever, that absolutely ruled out emotion and subjectivity and human form, at least theoretically, if not in actuality. And was that something that you were at one time attracted by and had to experience a coming away from it? Or was that something which from the outset you felt, this isn't me? You, Judith, had a little different situation because you were coming at it from a fashion design angle, not a studying sculpture per se angle. But then when you started in, this obviously was still the climate.
Right. I think that I mean, as much as I always thought the Judds were very beautiful, I felt that they were emotionally too stingy for me,
yeah.
From what I was, I don't know what, looking for and trying to do. I do think I was very lucky that I studied fashion first and then art, because I think I would have learned welding and all those things that I would then have to backed away from. So I didn't. I had a very direct line learning how to build the figure.
Yes.
That way.
Yeah.
But as I say, I mean, I don't know what I called it, but we definitely didn't use that word.
Yeah.
My work's deeply indebted to minimalism, and I think that I could understand the vocabulary. It had a kind of rational aspect that I was attracted to. The first work I exhibited with equivalent weights, 75 pounds of magnesium and 75 pounds of steel. And I did pieces where I had a piece of steel that was the equivalent weight of a column of space that went into infinity, to the end of the atmosphere. I still have that lying around somewhere. My real conclusion, and I actually thought there was a lot of emotional aspect in minimalism. I think the literature around minimalism denied its emotionality. And so I think if you look at Carl's work and you see that, this is 3/8 inches off the floor, that's his sense of self, that's an emotional statement. And I mean, I don't say that in a negative way. I'm really not being negative, you know. But they're profoundly emotional, and Don's the negativeness in Don's work, I think, really affected me. But I think where I would, you know, and I felt that I couldn't pursue that path, I had to deal with, you know, reference, because that whole area was taken up, and it was too abstract for me to participate in without being, you know, some sort of miming fool. And I think now, when I look back on it, I think the aspect of minimalism that really interests me, and I was talking about, is that sort of its total dependence on architecture as a support and ground. You know, the way painting is dependent upon the flatness of the canvas. This is something that minimalism really was involved with. So, you know, it was, yes, tasteful, beautiful, elegant, emotional, you know, but it sits on any space. And it's conditioned by this sort of geometry of the wall and the floor. And I think in a way, you know, that just doesn't seem, there's so much greater expressive possibility. So that's why I'm tossing shapes up. You know, well, I can't, you know, the fact is all I can do is a rectangle. I can do other stuff too, you know. I can do this and I can do that and I can finesse it and I can make organic stuff if I want to, or something that's figurative. But, you know, so it's the way it enters the world and its acceptance of kind of sort of, you know, this sort of international style that's really, you have to, and now it's become full-blown decor.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the lingua franca of decor. Minimalism.
Here's our
is,
table.
Yeah, minimalism is not radical.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, but, and how does that organ, so the organization of thought on the floor, on the wall, on the tabletop, I mean, just so flat, so predictable. What does all that amount to in terms of the possibility of expression, which is the way I would address that? But I think those guys are actually, I think those artists, men and women, are very emotional in their reserve. I think the language around it was totally, you know, they wanted it to be explicable and pragmatic. And I think Judd was very involved with pragmatism and denied all sorts of emotionality.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you look at one of his copper pieces with a big red bottom, you know, it looks like this big pool. I mean, he's engendered space, particularly in some broad way, that's really profound.
Yeah.
And I'm not a lover of this work, but I mean, you know, and Tony Smith, I mean, how much more emotional can you be? So I think geometry as a mask of emotion doesn't fly. I mean, there's plenty of emotion in this work.
Do you feel that, or if you can remember, that you had a sense of either internal resistance or resistance from others in that, in both of your cases, I think, the work actually in some ways skipped back half a century at least and started talking, whoever you want to say, Giacometti, Rodin, to this sculptural tradition of the figure in bronze?
Well, I know when I first... Hugo.
Well, finish what you were going to say.
The first bronze I showed this little piece of Paula's in 73. It was a little balsa wood bridge, you know, and a kind of, a carved boat. Really melodramatic. I don't know if melodrama is emotion. That's my level of maturity. In a coffin, you know, I was emotionally distressed, and I had this little bronze bird I made in one hand, and I cast that in bronze. I remember getting a lot of crap for that. That God forbid you use bronze, which is about multiplication and truth to material and Brancusi. And I said, well, you know, Giacometti actually interests me more. So there was real resistance.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Well, the resistance, you know, on my part goes beyond long before when I started bronze. I mean, you know, I sometimes to amuse myself, I'll pull out, you know, a bunch of early reviews of the work of the cloth work, you know, which
is how you have a good time.
No, but I mean, just to remind myself, you know, I mean, now it's a kind of genre, clothing as a sculptural form. But in fact, in this room is a friend of mine, Maureen Connor, and she and I had our first gallery show at the same time up on the Upper East Side in 1980. And she was working at that time also with, in a very different way, but with clothing elements. And she was deconstructing them and looking at them more in terms of more from the social side, if I'm not saying you wrong. We were reviewed by the same critic in the New York Times, and the headline, I can never forget it, was, "Two women take craft to a higher plane." So, you know, it was hardly either of our aims. And so, you know, there. So, yeah. But for me, that working with that had a variety of ground plans. One, as a woman, it was about women's stuff. It was mm-hmm. about, I never studied art because I went to Catholic schools, and there was only when I was a senior in high school was there one art class. I took it twice so I could get twice as much time to work. But also people, young people in those days were taught how to paint. I can never face a blank piece of paper. Yeah. So, you know, for me, I asked my mother to teach me how to sew when I was six. So that, for me, is the 3D world that goes back that deep. Now, you know, I don't think most men in those days had that experience. And rather than leave it behind, I took that as a foundation of my three-dimensional thinking.
Yeah.
By the time I moved to the bronze, which I explained in my talk, it was like technological problem solving, and then it took on this whole other thing. But I remember I applied for an NEA grant, which I got, and I got with it an exchange to go to France, and then I did a little side trip to London to look at all the 19th century sculpture that modernism had reacted against. Because in a way, if you looked at the 20th century in the late 60s, it was like, okay, you can only go so far with Giacometti. You can't even really go too far with Rodin, because in a way that's 19th century.
Yeah, yeah.
There's Brancusi, but who, you know, how many others? There was Chaim Gross. I mean, there were a few people that I dug for.
Yeah.
So I went to look at all the French gardens and all the British gardens and all that, and it was all the over-the-top gilded lily figuration, but what I got out of it was, okay, this is what they hated. This is what they worked against. So how do I somehow pull that, you know, I mean, why throw it all out?
Yeah.
Pedestals were part of it. I mean, there was a whole vocabulary of forms that had basically been thrown away.
Yeah.
But that's a construction. So, I mean, I think these shows at the Orsay are really about looking at the continuity between centuries.
Yeah.
That I think, so, you know, when something's new, you define it. And then after a certain time, you integrate it, possibly. And, you know, there's probably far more in common between a 19th century or a 17th century artist and a 20th century artist than there's different.
Yeah.
Although they're really doing radically different things. But the emotional state can be very similar.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think there's a lot of
consequences. Right.
That's a fault.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree, but, you know, it's this sort of silly. It's an important argument to deal with the radicality of 20th century art. But in the end, you know, it's still part of this broader continuum and discourse that transcends sort of its temporal aspect.
Yeah. Well, there's the human thing.
Condition,
which isn't,
that informs it forever on.
Yeah. You were both talking about the sort of surprise that greeted your work at a certain point. Did either of you get a negative review ever that actually caused new work to get made? You know,
Kleiner Kunst. I had a review in Jury, Kleiner Kunst, which is really like, that's the worst thing in the world. You know? But maybe it was in Sweden, small art. So it wasn't about small scale. It was like, this is real crap. I was hurt. I mean, that's the problem. As miserable as you know the intellect behind the writer, you're still sort of painful. I myself read reviews carefully, you know. It doesn't last. But, you know, you go on your merry path. But you absorb it. I think it informs work to some extent. At least in my case. I mean, I don't know how it does, but, you know.
Nothing that you can think of that was, like, inadvertently constructive. Offhand.
Yeah, I mean, when Roz Krauss wrote about my work, I had this way of framing the work intellectually, which I knew about, you know, emotionally, but I don't think I quite had the language. And that was really gave me a lot of kind of, you know, it gave me a certain sense of self and importance that would allow a certain amount of movement forward and exploration.
Yeah.
I mean, I think criticism is important. Even negative.
I just remember one. First of all, I think, you know, when you talk about someone like Joel or myself, I mean, just to continue going for that many years as an artist,
yes.
Where that's coming from is so much deeper than a bad review. You know,
I
mean, I don't think it can really finally influence you that deeply.
Yeah.
But there was something where somebody talked about the new narrative in the work. And I remember thinking with horror, again, I mean, I myself was still fighting with the whole language of figuration because I had been trained at a time when it was a dirty word. You know, so I was talking about it in terms of permutations and, you know, the grid. I mean, Czech's Pants, for example, that Wiremesh thing was a way of saying, you know, trying to have some humor with it, like, if I have to do the grid, here you go. But I thought, narration, oh my God, you know, what am I, you know, what is that? Is that how it looks to people? And it was because I had put two figures together. That was the progression for me, was just to make it bigger, more complicated. So the next body of work, I actually coupled each figure with an inanimate object.
Yeah.
A cube, you know, the famous ones, a cube, a pyramid, as a way of saying, finding out for myself, if I could I put two things together and not create a narrative in the sense of a romantic relationship or whatever? You create a narrative anyway because it's a formal narrative. Yeah. But so that was a positive reaction.
Yeah. And the last question I had wanted to ask from this seat really was in alluding to what you just said. With both of you now having almost 40 years of making sculpture, can you define or identify any changed approach? You're tougher on yourself, you're easier on yourself, you're more free, you're more strict, you're more open to inspiration, you're more open to message, or do you see yourself in a different position than 25 or so years ago that you can feel is reflected? I mean, I'd like to think of you both still in mid-career, but the...
Me too, thank you.
But the sense of a track record there, you know, on the one hand, it makes things easier, and on the other hand, I would imagine also makes things harder.
I'm more perfectionistic than I used to be,
uh-huh.
which is insane, but there it is.
Unfortunate.
Yeah, and technologically so. You know, sort of the more you know, the more you want to know, the more you want to do. So I have to restrain myself from overreaching my ability sometimes, I feel.
Yeah.
But then also there's you know, the wonderful, I mean, when you love art, it's like, the more you go on, the more you really can admire how somebody could have done such and such. And you want to do that. You know, you want to make something that's that profound before you keel over. You know, that. So I guess that's also makes it harder.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a sort of, as you get, as I guess I'm older, I hate the concept that I'm an artist in my age. But anyway, now and then. But I just feel freer in my studio, you know, to do stuff. And I'm more disappointed. I mean, I think, you know, eventually you know so much more. I mean, I know so much more about sculpture than I knew, you know, 30 years ago. And I think that you have to overcome that. I mean, you have to absorb that knowledge and then you still need this sort of internal moment and rage, it's not rage, whatever it is, this impetus to externalize thought. And I think now, you know, I'm willing to do things that are much wilder, I hope. But they're not wild enough. So, I mean, I still sense all this massive limitation. Nevertheless, you know, one always addresses their limits. I mean, I think you try to expand beyond them. I mean, I think that's sort of the purpose of it all.
Questions from others?
Oh, well, I was using kind of psychoanalytic term for those small, like the small little chair, those three little figures. I mean, this work that I did, work that were these kind of almost bunkers you'd have to penetrate through these small holes mentally, psychologically, into this magical world, like a fairy tale. I mean, I'm reducing it. They weren't fairy tales. But they didn't function in the actual space that we that we're in. It was functioning in some other space, the modern as a piece with a house. I mean, there's this sort of very tender, delicate, almost surreal space that I was making the work in. And in order to see the work, you'd have to enter into it. And there's a certain point where I just felt, well, you know, I'm a big boy. I mean, I want the work to be in the actual space of the world. I mean, So it's not it wasn't childlike. Well, I'd like to use the word magical. It was sort of almost fairy-like. I mean, a little chair, you know, that insists on itself. It's 3 inches. It's a very insistent, demanding piece. Little chunk of space in front of it is actualized. But I mean, I really wanted to encompass broader realms, and that's so the wood piece downstairs. In relation to the small little ones, you read the little ones as a sign. You don't really get actively involved in their spatial situation. The bigger one actually engages and has vectors and things like that. So it's like going from a more conceptual to a more actual situation.
I mean, that's happened in both of your works, actually. I think the sort of publicness has increased over the years.
It's more accessible.
Yeah, or the admission that these are exchanges with the public.
Right. Well, I always just try to pull people into this magical place. I'm still as manipulative, but in a different way.
Yeah. In the back.
The figure of that one is a wooden timber that I bought from a guy who deals in hardwoods, and it had been part of a railroad trestle, and it has holes through it. They look like black spots in the picture, but one of them you could actually see through to light. So. I had made a bunch of heads, thinking I had a bunch of figures, and I had the heads made because the heads were cast. And when they came back to the studio, I almost invariably didn't like any of the heads for the particular bodies, so I started mixing. And I was trying things out, and I liked the fact that the holes were in the head as well as in the body. I think in the middle period where I use the word figures, they really are, you know, with very much a self-consciousness about them as sculptures, as about forms, figure form. And I really didn't anticipate, but that once I actually started making the figure, I mean, it was as visceral as I remember the first head that I made for a figure, and I was modeling in clay, which I don't really do that much, but just somehow I was. And, you know, like anything you make, your work, you're watching, your eyes are watching your hands. That's basically the thing you're doing all day long. And all of a sudden, it was a face looking at me. It was just a shocking experience. And it was one of those, you know, sort of flash experiences where I think, God, every figurative sculptor in the history of time has had this experience once. And it's that's the difference somehow. To make a good face, you have to have what's behind the face. It has to come out, I think, maybe. I think that's so.
Are you working with models now, or is it still?
I never work with models. They're just, you know, they kind of, you just keep working. You're looking for something, and it, and you stop when you find it.
Yeah.
A question in regards to drawing inspiration and kind of extending that. Are there any artists who are early in their career currently that you are surprised by or looking to with any interest or inspiration?
Louder. Who inspires?
Are there any inspirations you're drawing from artists who are early in their career?
Younger artists today.
Oh, art, you mean young artists today functioning?
Yes.
I mean, who I think are interesting?
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know a lot of them, unfortunately. I mean, I think there are quite a few. Jeff Koons, I think, is interesting. At his best, you know, not a lot of it. But, I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I don't see enough of it, though. I mean, I try and be more to go to exhibitions. What else interests me? Sculpture-wise, is there a lot of? There's not a lot of sculpture. I mean, mostly it's all sort of conceptual gibberish that I see a lot. I mean, there's not a lot of form making. I mean, in the end, I'm interested in people who make forms, and what that form means in the world. So, I don't see a lot of that.
Same.
Well, there's a lot of figurative work now, which I'm enjoying seeing, and I respond to that. So there's, you know, Charles Ledre's work I love.
That's cute.
Judy Fox, I think, is interesting. I can't say I love it, but I think it's really fascinating and very good. I mean, I have students working with the figure that I, you know, that there's a student that I had at Penn last year named Rachel Frank, who's making these enormous horses that are sewn. I mean, you know, so that's my bias is to, you know, to figuration of all sorts. But I think there's a lot of interesting things going on. And there's a lot of junk, I think, too.
I don't have any bias towards anything. I don't care if it's figurative or not, as long as there's some kind of, you know, as long as it advances the discourse a little bit or the possibility of making stuff.
I had another student who was doing, like, she could have been Exter, Jessica Slavin. I mean, she could have been doing what Exter did in the Russian constructivist period. And, you know, I think it's the reinvention of the wheel is always fascinating to me because there's new things, some of which I don't like, but there's lots of, you know, I think there is common ground.
Yep. And a sense of pluralism, I guess, that's really different from when you started out.
I think, as Joel said, I mean, the pluralist, both the pluralistic aspect, the globalistic aspect,
yeah,
of the, and the size of the scene in New York from when we started out, just makes it very hard to follow as much as one would want,
yeah,
because there's so much more to see.
Yeah, I get it. Little glimpses now and then. I go to the Whitney show. I mean, I went to the show at PS1. I'm on the board of the Sculpture Center, so I've looked at those shows. You know, I see stuff that interests me. I mean, there are younger artists. Keith Edmire's interesting. I think there's a lot
going
on.
You're not feeling pessimistic about sculpture in the 21st century?
No, I'm much more optimistic than most critics. I mean, you know, a guy like Michael Kimmelman dismisses the possibility, I mean, he somehow, you know, something has to be environmental to be meaningful. It's so stupid. It's such a small read on work.
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't get it. What's the difference? I mean, between something that, you know, people had trouble with the David Smith show.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually met people, a major critic who said it's not relevant anymore.
Yeah.
I said, you're mad. I said, go back and look at it. And what the hell's using this and, you know, what Jessica Stockholder does or what somebody else does.
Yeah.
Except it's all, you know, more contained in a certain place rather than spewing across walls in the room.
Yeah.
What in the world? So people are seduced by so little. That always never fails to impress me.
Yeah.
You know, that it doesn't take a whole lot for people to respond to stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of dumb bunnies out there.
Maybe sitting right among you.
That's okay.
Yeah.
This is for both of you. I'm wondering if you, in addition to your studio work, also teach? And if you do, how you experience that relationship with your studio work?
I have taught for many years, but at this stage I have a more limited teaching schedule, which I like, which is just a visiting critic at Penn. How does it relate to my studio work? It doesn't really. I don't think of it that way. Part of why I enjoy teaching is because, you know, I can go out and look at shows and be clueless about what some young artists are doing because it's just coming from such a different place. By teaching, I am more clued in to the thinking. You know, like, I didn't grow up on television, and I certainly didn't grow up on the computer. And now I'm dealing with artists who did, and they really do think differently. Some things are the same, you know, certain needs are the same, I think. Certain of artists' needs are consistent, but the vocabularies really do change. So I enjoy it for that reason.
I used to teach years ago, but I've taught a class a couple of years back, 5 or 6. I found it really difficult. And if I'm involved in doubting my own work, you know, then I doubt everything the kids do. And sort of, I gave this talk, and I was going through a difficult phase in the work, and I mean, they couldn't deal with it. This was at Harvard. These kids could not deal with it. And I showed the little chair. So, and I talked. I mean, I wasn't optimistic and enthusiastic and ever supportive. And I've decided that I just can't teach. I'm a liability as a teacher. I'm just so undermining. And, you know, the kids, yes, everyone. And then if they do have a good idea, you know, you sort of tell them what to do.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in the end, the kid's taking credit for it. And you sort of, well, you know, I say, well, you know, I was really guiding you and I saw this piece at the University of Pennsylvania in a graduate student show. And, I mean, I think it's really hard to do.
Yeah.
I'm not good. I'm too preoccupied with myself to really teach. And I'm being straight.
David?
A question about the process of taking a thought and putting it into a form that you mentioned earlier, what you talked about, and especially this question that Anne brought up too, as you get older and you create a body of work, what is it that kind of sparks you at this particular stage to come up with a new idea or a form? Is it primarily looking at your own work and exploring, or are there other means as well? Discussion, reading, ideas, other aspects of exploration?
Desperation.
I think
you do a body of work and you don't fully understand it. I mean, the understanding is in the doing. It's not like you have a preconception of what you're going to do. You do it, and it's really directing and dealing with various problems. And then you sit back and you analyze it, and it's not this kind of rational analysis. And then when you begin to work, you address it again, and, you know, transform it into something else. So, I mean, that's an exciting process, but it can also be, it takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard work.
Yeah.
Is the emotion always there, or do you have to come up with something to create?
Well, I don't think there. No, I mean, I think it's the absence of emotion that forces you to find it in the work. I mean, it's a very complicated. You know, I don't have some burning emotion, but I mean, I can recognize it in form. I can recognize meaningful form.
That creates an emotion, though.
Well, I don't know what it creates, but I mean, that's what I would look for. I mean, I did a couple of pieces that one that I really like. And I know now, if I look at my work, what really interests me, when I'm doing these wire things that I hang, and if they're really not good, they refer to Cubist space. If they're really good, they refer to some other situation. I don't know what the situation is, but I know that interests me. That's really good. I said, when I can look at it and it looks like, you know, it looks like something that could have been done in 1921 in Moscow, you know, with some constructivist thing. But if it transcends that because of some particular internal aspect that I'm giving it, that's really, you know, that's, to me, strong. I mean, yeah, but I mean, when I say emotion, it's not, you know, the little pieces may have been about, you know, fear, rage, you know, stuff like that. I don't think that's anything that I'm involved with now. I think it's much more complicated, much more abstract.
Well, I can sit here and you're talking and I take a note and trigger. You trigger something. It's not what you said. It is what you said, but it's something completely different.
Well, the process, whether it's figurative or not figurative, is extremely abstract. I mean, I don't think, you know, maybe less. I don't know. I can't talk about contemporary, what's going on now. I don't know enough about it. I don't have the time. Getting through, you know, day to day and getting your work done and this and dealing with various responsibilities. I mean, I don't see how people go to galleries twice a week to see everything.
It's good to listen to you, though.
Yeah, well. I'm older.
Last one.
Well, I mean, I met Ed. I mean, I had this photograph. There was this miserable photo of Ed and Paula, lean Ed, you know, Paula looking very cute, and Ed's like 6'4". He was just very enthusiastic about work. I mean, I knew him and interacted with him. We were friendly. I mean, we never were close. I went to some parties, and we talked about stuff. He was very enthused and very kind of involved with the process of what artists make and how they made it. And, and I think there's one core in the work is that it's not predictable. You know, it's not of a certain school. It's not about taste. It's really about some kind of humane or humanist point of view. I don't think it's old-fashioned either. At least in terms of, I think in terms of throughout, there's this real consistency in the show, and it manifests itself with many different artists in many different forms. But there is
who
this
you would never think go together.
Yeah, but yeah. There is this real core of humanity in the work. And I think, in the end, Ed was this kind of very humane guy. I mean, not at all pretentious. I mean, he was sort of down to earth. He had made $1 gazillion because he was this shrewd real estate guy, and he decided. I mean, I was close, and I still am close with Joan Simon. And Joan was supposed to be his curator. Joan really had advised Ed early on. I mean, I think if there's you sense the strong hand of Joan and David McKee in the show. Mm-hmm. And I think he really, you know, we were two kind of soulful, real, kind of difficult, funky people. I mean, they weren't polished salesmen. Or in their own way, maybe, you know, David is. But so you have this core sense in the show, and I think you read it.
Did you meet him?
Yeah. And I agree. And I think what you said, I mean, if anybody is interested in the man, I thought between your interview and John's essay, there's really a very good depiction of him. In addition to what Joel said, I found him, he had this incredible intensity. That's the thing I remember most, is just that real intense. It was like split second, you know, like it, don't like it, not afraid to say either way. And I think the collection shows that. But I think, to me, the core thing that I learned in the catalog that is so telling about his collecting habits is to think that he bought that Guston painting Source. That was his first artwork that he bought. It's the painting, the show of the... It almost is abstract, except that very readable eyes and eyebrows and the green sort of halo of Musa, basically. And in its time, that would have been just such a way out, insane, bizarre painting.
What year did he buy that?
'69?
So when was the big Guston show at Marlborough, the critical show that where the work...
The disaster.
The first manifest.
70.
Right,
yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a kind of gut reaction, that I think is what he was about.
And he was so self-deprecating about it in this other characteristic way of his, which was like, I had the advantage that since I knew nothing, none of the criticism or the discussion about how awful these paintings were had reached me.
I think he had real faith in people and kind of in the human discourse. I mean, he was a very unpretentious guy.
The
fact that his museum didn't occur, I mean, it was sort of inevitable. I mean, Soho became... And I think it dawned... The whole naivete of opening up a museum.
Yeah.
And, you know, this sort of must have been some...
It Don Quixote.
Me away from it because all of a sudden it was going to have, you know, tours and it was... It was becoming this full-fledged institution.
Yeah.
I think that's something...
It hit him hard late. Yeah. Yeah. No, that was a nice question to wind up with. And thank you very much, everyone, for coming, and to both of you.